The interview we're doing today is the interview we had planned for last week, and unfortunately we had some technical problems. So this week we're a go, and we're going to be talking about the Islamic religion and animal rights and animal welfare. Welcome to the show, Orphan.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for agreeing to talk with us today. I wanted to start out just very generally by talking about some things around Islamic views of animals, and maybe you could talk to our listeners a little bit about what Islamic texts actually say about animals and how these things can be interpreted to support animal welfare or animal rights.
Sure, absolutely. There are sort of two major, I guess, textual sources for Islam, and the main one is the Quran, of course, which is seen in Islam as sort of the, you know, actual direct revealed word of God. And then there's also what are called hadith, which are sort of reports of what the Prophet Muhammad did or said in his life. So it's from those two sources that you find sort of the religious bases for all views in Islam, and including the animal view. Now, in the Quran, for example, sort of the general idea about animals is that, you know, they're not simply resources for humans to use. That there are a lot of chapters that talk about animals as sort of being a special part of creation, that animals sort of pray or offer their praise to God. Even though humans might not understand how animals are doing this, animals are certainly doing this in their own way. I don't know if you want me to read any of these passages.
Sure, it'd be nice to hear a short passage.
Sure, okay. Let's see. There's one that says, "See you not that it is God whose praise all beings in the heavens and on earth do celebrate, and the birds of the air with wings outspread. Each one knows its own mode of prayer and praise, and God knows well all that they do." And there's another one that's interesting, again, that shows that animals and humans sort of share special place in the creation, and it's a chapter that says, "And your Lord revealed to the bee, saying, make hives in the mountains and in the trees and in human habitations." And the word that's used for revealed is wahi, which is the same word that's used when a human prophet receives prophetic revelation. So it's sort of showing that this similar special sort of communication goes on not just between humans and God, but also between God and animals.
One thing I wanted to know is if in the Islamic text, if there's a misinterpretation of things that happens. I know in both Jewish religion and in Christian religion, a lot of people talk about dominion over the animals, and they use that to say that they should be able to do whatever they want to animals, and that animals are on earth for human purposes. Does
right.
the same kind of thing happen in Islamic law?
Yes, and the thing is in... it's a misinterpretation in some ways. Now, in light of what we've said already about the Quran being some sort of explaining in some way how animals have a special place in creation, it also does say in certain points things like, we, meaning God, have made cattle for you to derive, or we've made cattle and you can derive, warmth from them, meaning you can use their skins, you can obtain food from them, and you can, use them for transportation. So there is this element in there that says, in some way, you have animals to use in particular ways, and of course it's always qualified.
Mm-hmm.
But the misinterpretation really comes in, I think, when you do start talking about dominion, and Muslims, just like Jews or Christians or people of other faiths, will say, well, since we have, permission in some ways to use animals, we can therefore use them in any way that we want. We can do whatever we want to them. And what's interesting about Islam is that it's seen as, when Muhammad received this revelation over the years of his life, it was seen as really a challenge to the pre-Islamic society, which is referred to as Jahiliyyah, which means the sort of the time of ignorance. And during that time, it has all sort of injustices like female infanticide, women being oppressed and things like that. And you also find a long tradition of cruelty to animals. A lot of animals had, their humps cut off or their tails cut off or maybe a leg cut off while they were still alive, so that the Arabs of that time could go ahead and, have their meat that way without, killing the whole animal. Mm. So one of the messages that Islam brought was that, you know, all those sort of treatments of animals are now forbidden.
Right.
You can, you know, you can't maim animals, you can't sort of notch their ears is one thing that they did, or put these sort of painful rings around their necks or brand them on their faces. Excuse me, things that, interestingly enough, nowadays are very similar to sort of the modern factory farming practices.
Mm-hmm.
So so in that sense, there is a provision for animals to be used when necessary, but that sense of dominion isn't really there. That's sort of a misinterpretation, as you said.
Mm-hmm. Often when people hear about or they think about Islam in terms of animal welfare, what comes to mind is questions around what halal means.
Sure.
Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Halal actually goes beyond even just sort of treatment of animals or eating animals. In some sense, halal, when you're talking about food, is very similar to the Jewish kosher laws.
Mm-hmm.
But halal is sort of the good end of a spectrum of either permitted or sort of neutral or forbidden acts. And the opposite pole of that would be haram, which we may talk about later, which are the sort of forbidden things to do.
Mm-hmm.
So something that's halal is anything that is sort of good and permitted by God. And so when you're talking about halal in the Islamic context, talking about food, what you're really talking about are, first of all, the types of animals that can be used for food, which does not, like the Jews, does not include pork. And there are certain technical things about, you know, which sort of sea animals can or can't be eaten and that sort of thing. And then there's also, as a component of halal, when you're talking about food, you have something that's called dhabiha, which is the actual manner of slaughter. And like the Jewish slaughter, the Islamic slaughter requires, you know, the slice across the throat, and certain other specifications like that. So that would sort of include halal, would be the animal and that's going to be killed for food, and then the way that which that is done.
Mm-hmm. I wonder when we, sort of a background for our listeners, when we talked with Roberta Kolchowski, who was with Jews for Animal
mm-hmm.
Rights, we talked quite a bit about the slaughter methods that are used, and something that she pointed out that I didn't realize is that the hoisting of the animals and then being slaughtered isn't the Jewish tradition.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so part of the cruelty that comes about is because of the rule that says the animal must be hoisted,
mm-hmm.
and then they slaughter the animal.
Right,
mm-hmm.
Right.
Does the same thing happen around slaughter according to halal? Are the animals first chained and then hoisted and then slaughtered?
They shouldn't be. To my knowledge, from the Islamic slaughter that I've seen in some other parts of the world, and then my understanding of how it goes on in North America, that's not the case. The animals are usually in some manner, whether they're stunned first or somehow pushed over, whether through a mechanical device like a box or sort of by human effort, they're usually cast onto their side and then slaughtered from that position.
Mm.
So, but you're right in that if they were sort of going along these sort of factory farming methods of hoisting and then slaughtering, again, that would be contrary to the principles of Islamic slaughter, which are really supposed to prevent these kind of cruelties. And there are a lot of these hadith from Muhammad and then from what are called his companions, sort of his close followers and those who kind of came after him in leadership of the community who, you know, if animals were denied water before they were slaughtered, you know, they were told that that was forbidden to do. There's a hadith about, you know, a man sharpening his knife in front of the sheep he's going to slaughter, and Muhammad says, you know, do you intend to kill this animal twice, once by sharpening your knife in front of him and then another time by killing him?
Mm.
So there are traditions like that that are trying to take a lot of the sort of excessive suffering out of slaughter. So if you're going to slaughter, then it should be sort of done in the best method and
mm-hmm.
the least painful and the least cruel.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned in halal that some animals are, you're allowed to be eaten while others are not.
Right.
I was wondering, for example, if you can talk about why there is abstinence around eating pigs.
Sure. And I think the good news is that means there's about, you know, 1 billion less consumers of
mm-hmm.
pork in the world, so I think that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's similar, really, in the way that I think Jews look at the eating of pig flesh, which is I mean, ultimately, it's because in the scripture, it's commanded by God that that's one of the things you can't eat. And of course, over the centuries that Islam has been around, people have tried to elaborate why that is. You know, is it because pigs are sort of omnivorous? They kind of can eat anything. And in Islam, in almost every case, the animals that are halal to be eaten are all vegetarian animals. So you don't eat sort of wild or carnivorous animals. So that's one way that some of the scholars have tried to describe the limitation. And the other one is through health, the health aspect that, you know, pigs may be more prone to trichinosis or other sort of diseases than other animals. So some people have tried to read into the Quranic prohibition of pork that, it's done for these health reasons, or it's done for, some kind of hygiene reasons or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, it's interesting because what often happens is cultural things start to come into play. So a lot of Muslims will start to think, well, if pork is forbidden, it's because, you know, pigs are filthy animals, or, you know, they're dirty. And they sort of, you know, might get to the point where they sort of see a pig as, you know, all things evil. I mean, sort of like we do in mm-hmm. Western talk, you know, if we call someone a pig or something like that. And, I mean, the thing is that Islam doesn't say anywhere that, because you're not supposed to eat pigs, you're not supposed to be nice to them. So those are sort of two separate areas that
right.
A lot of Muslims have problems with.
You mentioned about the rule about eating animals that are vegetarian, and is there a controversy or debate about the fact that factory farmed animals might, who are supposed to be vegetarian or naturally mm-hmm. are vegetarian, may well be fed protein sources that are from other animals, like chickens being fed chicken meal and things like that?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's been one of the sort of heartening things that we've found as the group and the website has been around, is that that is one major issue that's come up, and that has certainly been discussed, and has put a lot of people, a lot of Muslims, I should say, off of eating meat, or at the least, sort of making them more aware of where their meat comes from, which we think is a better step, because at least if we can sort of get people out of the realm of factory farming, and if Muslims decide to eat meat and they are getting it from a local farm, or they really know how the meat is being produced, how the animal's treated sort of from birth until slaughter, at least that's a step in the right direction in our view.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of halal, in terms of factory farming, are there concerns about the actual raising methods of the animals and the way that they're treated? I mean, is part of halal being merciful to animals and being compassionate to them? And if so, can factory farmed animals be considered halal, even if the slaughter is proper?
Right. That's an excellent question, and that's one of our major platforms, is that that they can't be, they shouldn't be, because the Islamic tradition is so much based on treating animals that you may use, whether it's for food or transport or anything, the treatment must be compassionate, it must be humane. You can't overwork your animals, you can't override your animals, you can't beat animals, all these sort of things. We think, of course, this is completely incompatible with factory farming. It's not enough just to do the sort of the biha slaughter at the end, the slicing
right.
of the animal's throat, that it has to be a sort of consistent, compassionate, as much as possible practice throughout the animal's life. And we're hopeful that this view will develop over time, because most Muslims, just like most people, are really unaware of the entire factory farming sort of paradigm and how it works. And so as people learn about that, and as Muslims learn about that, they're really turned off of the idea. So we definitely have people who write to us after seeing, some of the slaughter footage, for example, that came out of India, which wasn't quite factory farming as you'd have in the West, but where there was a lot of mistreatment of the animals before slaughter.
Mm-hmm.
And just seeing that, they say, well, there's no way that we can eat this sort of meat, that's against Islam. So
mm-hmm.
I think the lag is that since people aren't aware of it, and since a lot of the Islamic scholars and jurists aren't aware of it, there just hasn't been any attention paid to it yet. So if we can kind of put...
Sorry, I think we lost our connection there. We have Irfan back on the line. Hi, Irfan. Sorry about
Hello.
That.
No problem at all.
I can't exactly remember. Were you in the middle of speaking there? Because I've lost my train of thought.
Probably
that
was.
Interruption.
You were talking about India before and how whether
right.
or not within the Islamic community, whether or not it can be considered halal anymore to eat these.
Right, right. I think we're talking about factory farming, and can that be can meat from factory farm animals be halal meat? And I just the one example I was using was India. And even though it's not quite the same sort of factory farming situation we have here, though they're certainly working towards that, just the treatment, there's a lot of inhumane treatment sort of meted out to these cattle who are killed as so-called halal meat. And so a lot of Muslims, upon seeing that, have really started to question the greater process and, you know, not just stopped sort of, as long as the meat has been ritually slaughtered in the right way, then they accept it. No, they've gone beyond that to really looking at the circumstances of the animal from birth until slaughter.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really echoed in terms of what's going on with the Jewish communities that are interested in these issues as well. I know that when we interviewed Roberta, she was talking about that, and when there was a speaker came up to York University who was saying there's a lot of debate in the rabbinical community about whether kosher is kosher anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to see how these discussions are sort of happening in many different communities right now, looking at these conditions which are, in terms of factory farming, Western imposed, and that type of ideology, as well as also being
right.
questioned as a way of treating animals. I wanted to just digress for a second, though, and to ask you a little bit about the organization that you're a part of and
sure.
how it got started, why it got started, and what are the primary goals?
Well, initially, we're kind of now realizing the initial goals for the group. And what had happened was People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals has a large, Muslim membership, and I'd begun working at PETA several years ago, and they had PETA had been receiving a lot of, suggestions and correspondence from Muslim members saying, there are a lot of things going on in the Muslim community that we think are problematic, the way animals are treated for food. And, we're vegetarians, and people, other Muslims tell us, it's haram, it's forbidden to be a vegetarian, and all this kind of stuff. So we'd sort of like to have an outlet to talk about this. And since I have a background in Islamic studies and was working at PETA, we decided to start this website that was called Islam Veg, that was sort of the second stage in sort of PETA's outreach to the religious communities, the first site being the Jesus Veg or Jesus Was a Vegetarian website. And we decided at the time just to focus on Islam and vegetarianism, mainly because it's certainly permissible to be a vegetarian in Islam. And since vegetarianism is sort of the main area where the majority of animals suffer, that's kind of what we wanted to look at first. And the group has kind of evolved now to what we had hoped it would originally be, which is looking at animals in the Islamic context and in all the ways in which people use animals, whether that's for food or for clothing or for vivisection. You name it, we kind of want to look at Islamic responses
mm-hmm.
to those questions.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're trying to do now.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine after September 11th stuff that the work that you face would be even more difficult, because so much of the rhetoric around animal rights is around terrorism, and so
right.
much of the rhetoric now, unfortunately, and before as well, is seeing Islam and seeing the Muslim community as being inherently terrorists
right.
as well. And I was wondering if you could respond to any responses you've had, or have you felt any of the impact then being part of sort of a bridge between these two groups?
Right. I mean, certainly, we kind of tend to feel it more from both directions with a lot of the legislation that's been pending against so-called terrorism legislation, whether it's against Muslims, and now some of this new legislation that's being introduced that's really focused at sort of animal rights groups and, kind of what has, PETA and SHARC and some of these groups have been implicated as,
mm-hmm.
terrorist groups in these
right.
bills and things
mm-hmm.
like that. So, I mean, that pressure is definitely there, but we've actually seen a better response from our emails now, as far as people, coming across the website and saying, wow, we thought, we had all these misconceptions and sort of issues with Islam, and now,
mm-hmm.
we're seeing that, wow, Islam isn't about warfare, and Islam isn't about cruelty, and isn't about killing. And so I think by giving this compassionate message and showing that, you know, not only is Islam, you know, concerned about what's going on in the world and social justice and human rights and things like that, but and you know, is against terrorism and things like September 11th, you know, that extends, you know, in some people's views, even to animals. Wow, they even care about animals. So that's, you know, really showing the depth of compassion in the tradition. So it's been it's actually been good. And I mean, beyond the sort of non-Muslims who come to the website, we also have a lot of Muslims who write in and say, you know, this is great. I thought I was the only vegetarian Muslim, and the numbers are really growing. So it's been positive.
That's wonderful to see it as the potential to open up the conversation in a really positive way or to raise awareness about it. That's fantastic to hear that you've had that kind of response.
Yeah, it's been great.
I wonder if we can jump back. You had mentioned about Islamic law around vegetarianism, and I wonder, are there Islamic or Muslim people who say that being vegetarianism is against Islam, and if there's Islamic requirements for ritual slaughter, for example, things like that?
Right. There certainly are. People who are sort of opposed to the idea of Muslims being vegetarians for a variety of reasons. I mean, the good news is that we've yet to ever see any sort of ruling from a scholar or a jurist or anyone that says you must eat meat. Mm. And in fact, we've listed several on the website. They've all said that it's entirely permissible to be a vegetarian, and there's no conflict with Islam or Islamic tenets or anything like that. I mean, a lot of the problem is sort of less to do with Islam and more to do with sort of cultural baggage, and especially, you know, we hear a lot of this from sort of the Indian subcontinent, where you have the Muslim-Hindu divide in, you know, Pakistan or India. And so, you know, if you eat meat, becomes a sign of sort of your cultural and religious identity. So Hindus don't eat meat, supposedly, and though that's changing, sadly, and, you know, Muslims do. So, you know, therefore, if you say, if I introduce myself as a vegetarian to someone, they must think, oh, is this some sort of Hindu idea, or is this, you know, a Western philosophical idea, something like that.
That's interesting.
So that's been problematic. So that's been one of our aims, is to show that, you know, there's inherently this message in Islam of concern for animals, and that it does extend, we think, to vegetarianism and to veganism, at least in the way that factory farming and everything is going on now, and that there's certainly no conflict, and that, you know, even the scholars recognize that. Now, the issue of sacrifice is more problematic, though we have seen some good signs. I mean, sort of the essence of the sacrifice for the major festivals that go on in Islam, the two major holidays, the major sacrifice is the one that's Eid al-Adha, which is coming up, I think tomorrow actually, which sort of commemorates the end of the pilgrimage of the Hajj to Mecca, at which time the people who make the pilgrimage are supposed to slaughter an animal and distribute the meat to the poor. And that's, what we've tended to see in the issue of sacrifice is that it says very clearly in the Quran that the sacrifice isn't meant to be some sort of, you know, blood offering to God. It's supposed to be, you know, a symbol of your piety, and that it's supposed to be done, it's sort of a change of the way the pagan sacrifices used to be, just sort of appease the gods, and instead, and, you know, kind of throw away the meat. Instead, it was sort of to show your piety to God by sacrificing something of great value to you, which, especially during the time of the Quranic revelation, was probably the livestock that, you know, a lot of these desert Arabs had to use to survive. And then the meat isn't really for you to keep, but you're supposed to distribute it to the poor. So you're supposed to, you know, somehow help out the poor. So there are certainly Muslims who have been saying, first of all, the treatment of animals is so important that, you know, if you're shipping, let's say, all these sheep from New Zealand or Australia to Saudi Arabia, and they're, you know, exposed to the elements, and they're suffocating on these ships, and they're not fed, and they're not watered, you know, how can you then think this is some kind of holy sacrifice? How can you sacrifice an animal that's been treated in that way? So, you know, whether or not sacrifice of an animal itself is something that can be changed or, you know, sort of overruled, or whether at least the treatment needs to change is one area of the discussion. And the other view of a lot of Muslims is just that this is supposed to represent sacrifice, and you are supposed to help the poor. So instead of, you know, paying a certain amount of money and buying a sheep, and, you know, that can only feed X amount of people, why not spend the money on vegetarian food that you can mm-hmm. feed, you know, five times the people or however many more, you know, that not only will you be more in line with the Islamic standards of compassion, but you'll also be feeding more people and, you know, helping out more. So that's the direction that some people are going in. And I think the most heartening thing was that last year at the, I think it was the Paris mosque, the imam there, the religious leader, said that sacrifice is not a necessity. It's not something that you have to do. Sacrifice of an animal, that is. And he said, instead, you can pay, I think it was a third of the value of an animal in cash to the poor, or you provide them with some other food so that you don't have to do the slaughter.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's good to hear that alternatives to it and are coming around, and even the world leaders are suggesting it as well. That's great.
Right,
You were talking earlier about India, and I wondered if we could jump back to that and talk a bit more about the way the number of issues around cattle in India. I think a lot of attention was given to you know, leather from India. I think Chrissy Hynde did protests even here in Toronto around that with I think, was it the Gap?
Yep, the Gap.
Yeah. So, but it's also an issue around meat, and especially around halal meat. And I wonder if you can explain the source of meat from India and what happens there and what the issues are.
Sure. The problem in India, well, there are several problems. And again, you're right. You talked about the leather issue, which is the main issue in the West. The Western countries, European and North American countries, are the main importers of leather from Indian cattle. And then the meat is sent to largely to the Islamic countries because it's considered halal meat, and that at least the formulaic sort of portion of the ritual slaughter is carried out. Now, the problem is, with India as such a large country and, you know, there's not a lot of infrastructure, you have cattle kind of coming from all over the country to select places where slaughter of cattle is legal. And when we're talking about cattle, we're talking about buffalo as well as cows. And so there are only a few places where that sort of slaughter is allowed on a large scale in India. So there's the issue of getting the cattle from sort of market to the point of slaughter, and the problems are really in the transport. One aspect of the transport are these sort of death marches that the cattle are forced to go on, which may be, you know, several days' journey in the hot sun. They're almost never, they're never given food that I saw while I was there. They're never given water, or very rarely. During these journeys, they're beaten to keep them moving with, you know, beaten with sticks and things like that. And probably the worst aspect is when those cattle who can't go on for some reason, they're just too weak, or maybe they break a bone or something like that. The handlers have these different tricks that they think are going to, you know, move the cows along, which, and of course, it doesn't work at all, including breaking their tails. And they kind of use this as a method to move the cows in general and the cattle in general, which is, you know, just to kind of use their tail as a handle, twist it if the, you know, cow's not doing what you want. It's kind of like, and they break it too, it's kind of like if someone was, you know, moving you by your fingers or like breaking your pinky or something like that to move you along. And then even worse is when they, you know, put in caustic substances into the cattle's eyes to sort of perk them up, as they say, you know, to kind of give them energy, to sort of irritate them into moving, I guess. And this can be, tends to be chili peppers. I mean, we've pulled, you know, sort of huge sections of chili peppers out of cow's eyes on the road in India. Tobacco, salt or pepper, you know, any kind of substance that's irritating that for some reason they think is going to make the cattle move along, they'll, you know, push that into their eyes. And then there's usually this sort of death march, and then there's also transport by truck. And the truck transport, besides being cruel, at least according to Islamic standards, is also in violation of Indian law, which specifies, you know, depending on the size of the truck, you know, 6 cattle or 10 cattle, something like that. And they're at least 2 or 3 times that much crammed into this truck. And again, the problems are they're not given food or water, no medical attention or anything like that if they're injured. They're crammed in. A lot of times they'll gore each other with their horns. A lot of animals will become suffocated if they fall, if they get trampled. They don't have sort of facilities for loading and unloading of cattle. So a lot of times they'll kind of unload against a hillside or something, and so the cattle come tumbling out and break bones or break their horns off or things like that. So that, in a halal context, of course, sort of each part of that is completely contrary to any of the Islamic teachings, whether they come from the Quran or from the Hadith or even from the law that's, you know, kind of been derived from those about not being cruel to animals. The slaughter itself can vary. Typically what we saw in sort of the modernized slaughterhouses was stunning of animals, which is a controversial issue, as you probably know, both in Judaism and in Islam.
Mm-hmm.
But they were stunning the animals and then slitting their throats. And we did see problems as far as the modernized slaughterhouses. I mean, their treatment was a little bit better, but, you know, it's such a, it's factory farming. It's this fast process, and so they'll stun an animal and then slit the throat, and the animal may not be dead yet, and they start the dismemberment process and skinning and all of that, which
mm-hmm.
is directly in violation of Islamic law, that you must make sure that the animal is completely dead before you begin any sort of cutting
mm-hmm.
of the animal. It's worse in the smaller slaughterhouses that are kind of spread out through India, because they're, since they really have lower standards, you'll find animals being slaughtered in front of each other, which is also contrary to Islamic law.
Mm-hmm.
They're, instead of sort of being cut with sharp knives so that the process is quick, they kind of use anything that can cut. So you find a lot of poorly placed cuts, a lot of animals struggling for life, even after they've supposedly been killed in the right way, and then a lot of live skinning and live sectioning of animals. And so, again, when you're talking about halal meat, we find it very hard to believe that any Muslim who knows about this could say that is halal meat,
mm-hmm.
Even though it's accepted as such and is sold all over the world, from the Gulf Arab states to Malaysia and Indonesia, Pakistan, even in some of the Western Muslim communities, you'll
mm-hmm.
find meat from Indian cattle.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you can explain how that system developed. I mean, it sounds inefficient for one thing, like the marches, and I just wonder
mm-hmm.
how that ended up coming about. Is it because there's just a few slaughterhouses, or is it to meet an increased demand for leather, or like you know, what happened to create that system?
I think a lot of it has to do with sort of the cultural history of India. There is a lot of use of animals for milk production, let's say. So a lot of cattle are milk-producing cattle.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of cattle are still used in agriculture and for transportation. And so once those cattle become, you know, not, they don't put out enough milk, or they're too old to sort of do their jobs, they're ending up now being sold to these cattle traders. And a lot of times there's deception involved. They say, you know, they're taking the cows to these cow shelters that they have, or they're, you know, going to take, you know, you might not want to use this cow for agriculture anymore, this ox or something, but, you know, we're going to use him in another farm. So, you know, these guys who have the cattle will sell their cattle to the traders, thinking they're going, you know, just to keep doing what they've been doing,
right,
not knowing that they're going for slaughter.
Right.
And there's also a prohibition against there's a resistance to setting up more slaughterhouses. And I mean, a lot of people in the Indian animal rights or animal welfare communities have said, you know, we're against slaughter and we're vegetarians and we don't wear leather, but since they're going to keep doing this, let's at least build more local slaughterhouses so that you don't have this transport element
mm-hmm.
involved, so that we can at least cut down the cruelty that way. But there's been a lot of cultural resistance and resistance from other animal rights activists who say, you know, if our goal is to stop slaughter, we don't want to sort of go, you know, turn away our animal rights views and go for more animal welfare by allowing more slaughterhouses. So
mm-hmm.
you have a lot of controversy over that issue as well.
Mm-hmm. How do you position yourself in relationship to those debates?
Well, I mean, I tend to think of myself as an animal rights person, not an animal welfareist. And that just goes in general. And I think in this particular instance, I mean, I think it makes sense. It's more compassionate to make the slaughter process easier, because I don't think that it's something that's going to stop anytime soon in India. There's too much of a demand, and there's not enough interest on the part of the average Indian and the part of Indian government officials to do anything to stop it. So the worst part is really this transportation, and it's just awful. So if you could eliminate that somehow, that's at least a step in the right direction. And I'm not sure what PETA's official stance is on that, but I know that, you know, were they even to support that, they certainly aren't, you know, compromising on the idea that let's get India back to, you know, its vegetarian roots and all that sort of thing. So, I think that's where I would come down, is that you've got to at least do as much as you can, you know, until you can do something more in the future.
Mm-hmm. Is there much action in India around this outside of, say, the animal rights community in terms of just public awareness about it or government reaction about it?
There's certainly growing public awareness, and it's from all communities. And what's interesting is that the issue of the cattle slaughter for meat and for leather is really a cross-community issue. Everyone that's involved, or the people involved, are from every Indian community, whether they're Muslims, Hindus, even the Jains, who are, object to taking any sort of life. You'll find rich Jains that profit from the trade in some way.
Mm.
So it really kind of goes throughout the Indian community. And you find sort of the same groups opposing it. You'll find sort of Indian, Hindu nationalists who are opposed to cattle slaughter in general, who are against it. You'll find sort of the growing, secularized or sort of westernized elites who are opposed to it. And, that's where you have an interesting split developing, because you had a lot of these sort of westernized people turning more towards Western habits as far as eating at McDonald's and, you know, pumping up your meat consumption and things like this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think PETA in India has been really going after them by using, the Bollywood stars, the big film stars in India and the Indian movie industry and sports
mm-hmm.
figures and things to make vegetarianism hip again in India. So you have opposition growing there. There are some government officials and ministers who are opposed to it, especially Maneka Gandhi, who's been fighting for animals for a long time in India. But the Indian government is very slow to react.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the face of these boycotts, and you mentioned the PETA campaign that started against the GAP, I think if you look at the PETA website now, there's dozens of major companies who used to buy leather from India. All the major labels, and they've all refused to buy Indian leather until such time as at least the Indian law and some basic humane standards are being enforced.
Mm-hmm.
But even this economic pressure and all the bad press they've gotten hasn't spurred the Indian government to do anything to make the situation better.
Mm-hmm. And I think enforcement is really key, because if you look at what's going on in North America, for example, I think some people will look at that situation in India and say, you know, over there it's so bad.
Right.
But really, I mean, you know, North America, we've seen many times in terms of investigations that have been happening in the U.S. and Washington, for example,
mm-hmm.
that animals are also being skinned alive, being dismembered alive.
Right.
The transportation is also terrible. And that's not to say that what's going on in India also doesn't need to be looked at as well, but it's not that issue around enforcement is so important to look at in many different contexts, including North America as well.
Absolutely.
I wonder if you have some suggestions for people who are interested in learning more or reading more. Are there some main books that people can read that you know about?
Sure.
Some other organizations, suggestions, and also your website, of course.
Right. Yeah. I'll give you some information now, and you can find most of this, again, on our website, which
mm-hmm.
is IslamicConcern.com, in the resources section. The major modern Muslim writer who wrote a lot about animals in Islam was Al-Hafiz Masri, who has passed away, I think, about 10 years now, but he wrote a sort of seminal book called Animals in Islam, which is out of print, but you may still find it in some places, in some libraries. That's a very good place to start. And I've actually heard that Compassion in World Farming is going to be reprinting the book, though I haven't heard anything on that for a while. So if anyone would like to ask Compassion in World Farming to reprint the book, that would be great, because it's really an important time for that now. But there are some more recent sources where you can find his writings. The first one is in a book called Religious Vegetarianism from Hesiod to the Dalai Lama, which just came out, I think, in the past year. That has several chapters on animals in Islam from various traditions. It has Masri's view, which is laid out nicely, and also the view of a Sri Lankan Sufi who's sort of a mystic Muslim named Bala Muhyiddin. So that has some very good chapters in it. And as far as vivisection, Masri has a chapter in Tom Regan's book, which is called Animal Sacrifices, which is about vivisection. So those two sources, I think, are fairly accessible. There's also a video made by Masri that you can borrow from PETA. There's information on our website about that. There are a couple other groups who are interested in the topic, Muslim groups. One is called the People of Allah, and they're in general a sort of group of Muslims very concerned with social justice, but they do promote veganism and animal rights. They're at peopleofallah.org. And then there's another group called the Muslim American Council for Consumer Advocacy, and they don't support a total vegetarian or vegan diet, but they're very critical of modern factory farming programs, environmental damage of meat eating, the humane issues. So they're another good resource, another good group of Muslims who are starting to look at these issues, and they're at macca-net.org. And then there's also a Muslim Vegetarian and Vegan Society in the United Kingdom. They don't have a website, but the address is on our resources list as well.
That's great. And certainly, if people want to contact us to get any of that information that they missed, they can reach us at...
Well, we're in the process of changing our email over right now, but you can write us right now at ciutanimalvoices@hotmail.com. So ciutanimalvoices is all one word, at hotmail.com.
Excellent. Irvin, most of the show we've focused on vegetarianism and meat eating, and I wonder if we can talk for a few minutes about some of the other... for Islamic people that are concerned about animals?
It is, and I think the sort of clearest instance of animals in entertainment that Islam is most definitely against is any sort of blood sports, dog fighting, cock fighting. I mean, in some of the traditional cultures in the Islamic world, there's been those sort of instances, or bear fighting, things like that, or bear and dog fighting, and those sorts of blood sports are definitely clearly stated in the hadith and the traditions that that sort of use of animals is forbidden. As far as things like circuses and things like that, I don't know if I can't think of any scholars I've seen really writing about the issues, but it's certainly one of the areas that we're going to be focusing more on the website, saying you're talking, because since the treatment is just so contrary to Islamic norms, it's something that really needs to be discussed and just hasn't been taken up so far.
And one other one I was interested to hear about was hunting. And I don't know if this is singularly to the Christian religion, but I found a website that was, you know, Christians for deer hunting, and they, you know, share scripture while they hunt deer. So it's very, you know, pro-hunting and pro-Christian. Are any kind of Islamic groups... Do they sort of use those kind of messages at all?
Not that I've seen. And again, because the Islamic message had the intention of sort of making life easy for people, it did permit hunting in certain circumstances, again, sort of as a matter of necessity and not a matter of sport. So as far as hunting for, again, as a blood sport, that would be something that's non-Islamic. If you had to hunt to survive, that's another matter. And I actually don't know many Muslims, aside from sort of so-called Muslims, you know, the aristocrats and ruling people in certain dynasties or families who support hunting. I mean, you found that in the Islamic tradition, a lot of the sort of nobility and those sort of people engaging in those sports, you know, sort of as happened in the West as well. But as far as the average Muslim, there's nothing like that. And thank God there isn't a Muslim hunting site yet.
I think we're going to be wrapping up pretty soon, but I was wondering, we started off the interview today with you quoting from the Quran, I believe, and I was hoping that you could maybe quote some more directly from some of the sources, the primary sources, as a way of closing the show. And also, if there's anything that we've missed that you think is, you know, important for us to talk about right now, there's definitely time to do that in the next 5 minutes.
Okay. As far as sort of, I guess, our goals, one of the major things that we're trying to do is expand the idea of halalness, you know, permissibility, to being vegetarian, first of all, which you'll see on the website. We mentioned halal vegetarianism, meaning it's healthy, it's allowable, so you should do that. So we're trying to work with major vegetarian foods producers, vegan food producers, cruelty-free producers, to get halal certification on their products, which is, again, similar to like the kosher certification that you'll see on a lot of products. And by nature, most of these products are safe for Muslims to eat, and I don't worry when I eat a vegan product that it's non-Islamic in some ways. And there are concerns for some Muslims as far as, you know, is there alcohol in the product or something like that, which would make it problematic. But in general, just by their nature, vegan foods are completely halal, so there's no question. But just to make it more accessible to the average Muslim, we're really trying to work with some of these companies, and thankfully we've had a lot of interest so far, to get their products with a halal certification so that we can promote them on the website and say, here's a list of halal in its widest, most comprehensive sense sort of products. And so that Muslim consumers can go to a store and see a product and, you know, see a symbol on it that they recognize means this is safe for me to eat, so that there's no question. So that's something we're working on and hope to see some good progress with. And as far as some of the passages, there's some good traditions that I'll leave you with. Perhaps the most succinct is that Prophet Muhammad said, whoever is kind to the creatures of God is kind to himself. And this is a very well-known and very well-established hadith.
That's excellent, Irfan. We're right out of time, and that was a perfect statement to end on.